This is episode number 52 with Danny Johnson.
Welcome to the Rise Higher podcast. I'm your host, Stephanie Kwong, and each week I'll bring you an inspiring guest with an empowering message to help you rise higher and live your best life. Each guest shares their time of struggle and setback and what specific mindsets, tools, practices, or habits they use to overcome so that you can apply them to your life. This show is to remind you that you're not alone and that there's always a pathway up. Thanks for spending some time with me today. I'm grateful to be on this journey with you. Our struggles are a call for us to rise. So here we go. Let's dive deep now so we can rise higher together.
What is up, my friends? Welcome back to the Rise Higher podcast. And thank you for spending part of your beautiful day with me today. Now, if you've been struggling with any grief, any trauma, or with your self-esteem, and you've had a hard time healing through it, this episode is going to support you with that. Today, I've got my friend Danny Johnson, aka Danny J, who is an award-winning entrepreneur. She's a keynote speaker, podcast host, and storyteller. And Danny is the former founder of the Sweaty Betties, an online fitness community, and she now teaches innovative brands and influencers to close more sales, become better leaders, and to blow up their brands with the irresistible power of sharing. Now, Danny's also helped tens of thousands of families become debt-free by sharing her real-life getting out of debt story and her challenge, hashtag Find the Money Project. Now, you can also hear Danny and her BFF, Jill Coleman, jam out every week on their weekly show, The Best Life Podcast. Now, as I said, if you've been struggling with grief, with trauma, or with your self-esteem, and you've had a hard time healing through it, this episode will definitely provide insight and wisdom for you to get to the other side. Now, Danny has been through the ringer, and today she openly shares in detail her personal struggles and all of the traumas and the harsh challenges that she's endured. I mean, it's crazy when you hear how much Danny's been through. From being molested to being a suicidal and pregnant teen that resulted in an adoption, to bankruptcy, to a bacterial infection that left her paralyzed for months and more. Like I said, it's a lot. And Danny also shares her beautiful process of healing and how she's managed to truly come through for herself and to surrender to trust and forgiveness. And Danny also shares how to rewrite your story and go from being a victim to a victor in your life. You know, we don't always choose or create the circumstances in our life. And the challenging circumstances that we experience are there to teach us, to grow us, and to evolve our consciousness if we're willing to rise. And because you're listening, I know that you are ready. And I know that you're going to be inspired as you hear Danny's rise through all of the challenges that she went through to remind you that you can do it too. So some of the things that we talk about today are how you're always guided and never alone, the importance of processing grief and ways to do that, how to rewrite your story to create a new future, why you must forgive and do the inner work to free yourself of the pain, the perspective shift that gave Danny her power back, how self-compassion stops the struggle, why validation must come from you and not from others, and how to stop giving a crap of what others think of you, and of course, so much more. Now, I can't wait to hear what you think of today's episode. Please share this episode out with your friends and family. And you can start doing that by taking a screenshot of this podcast that you're listening to, share it out on your Instagram, on your Facebook, wherever you do your socials, and make sure to tag me. If you're using Instagram, you can tag me at I am Stephanie Kwong to spread the love, because you never know who may need to hear this message today. So go ahead and share it out. All right, let's do this. Here we go with Danny J. Welcome to the Rise Higher Podcast, Ms. Danny Danny.
Yay!
Before we started rolling, I was like, holy crap, we just got to hit the go button because there's so much that you've experienced in life and overcome that hopefully we can keep this to an hour.
I know. That's the, like, I have to do bullet points on some things. Okay. You have to gloss over some things sometimes. You're like, yeah, I was paralyzed, but we'll talk about that one later.
Yeah, I was paralyzed. Yeah, I found out that I was my dad wasn't my dad, but we'll talk about that later.
Yeah.
But I would love to start, and we'll move through a lot of this because I think there's, and especially digging into the tools and the growth that you've had through it, because you are such an extraordinary woman. I love being in your presence. I love when we run into each other at events or I get to come to your events celebrating you and the podcast that you have with Jill. You guys got to check that out. It's the Best Life Podcast, which we'll talk all about. But you've just endured and overcome so much. And I feel like all that inner work that you've done by the presence that you have when I'm with you. And so I'm really excited to deep dive even more into that and to share your story, your journey, and your wisdom with
audience. I appreciate that. Yeah. You know what, like what you just said about the deep work, it really is. It's so funny because I've been through a lot. And sometimes when I talk about it, it's, you know, when you actually get through some things, it becomes easier to talk about. And then it's kind of like you're talking about someone else. Yeah. And you're just like, yeah, you can nonchalantly talk about something traumatic that happened without having emotion attached to it. And that has taken a lot of work. But it's also just a testament of, I just hope that I can be an example of when people feel like they're struggling or going through something hard, that you don't have to be stuck in it and that you can get through it. And you can even ironically laugh about it. Like there are certain things. I was just driving over here and was chatting with my friend and I said, my husband had an affair. And when this happened, I was a wreck. I mean, there's no way you could have told me a few years later, I could like send memes to my friends about people cheating on each other. And I just think it's funny. And I'm going, sometimes it's just a coping mechanism, but there's just ways that you can get through. And there's not one way. Like there's so many things that I've had to go through and just realize it really is a lot about our perception and the stories you tell yourself. And yeah, I just hope that when people hear some of it, even though it sounds outrageous, I feel that if you can just kind of flip it on yourself and go, okay, if this person could go through something traumatic or scary, then I can get through it too.
Yeah, it's – and I love that that's what you do through a lot of your work is you share your story so authentically with people and then share what the lesson was and how they can just shift that. Like when I interviewed Lisa Bilyeu, who's a mutual friend, like she just said, she's like, do you know all that Danny's been through? And I was like, I mean, most of it, and I can read about it, and also I follow your stuff, but it's incredible, Danny. Like, let's start from the beginning. I mean, even before we were rolling, you're like, there was a moment, well, thank goodness for hypnosis, but you discovered something, or you were experiencing anxiety as a kid, right? And I know from another interview, you also had an eating disorder as a child, which we know is not about the food, it's about something else, but if you want to start there.
Yeah, so of course, the eating is never about the food. So it's funny because the story has just come up over the last few years, ironically, and it was kind of a story that was low, like laying underneath everything in my whole life, and I didn't realize until more recently and doing hypnosis. But it kind of started all around the same time. I was 13 years old. My dad was driving me to gymnastics, and in the car, he just blurts out, you know, I'm not your real dad, right? And I was like, what? And I remember thinking we had pictures in an album of my mom having me and I was like bloody and I knew I came out of her. I saw her pregnant. So I was like so confused because I'm going, I'm not adopted. And it didn't occur to me that maybe there was an affair or anything. I just didn't get, like, I don't get it. I'm like, I don't understand. And he said, well, I couldn't have kids. I had a low sperm count and we used a sperm donor. And then he dropped me off at gymnastics. And in that moment, I remember just feeling so scared and worried. And then, of course, after I got back from gymnastics, we didn't talk about it the whole way home. And finally, I woke my mom up in the middle of the night, asked her if it was true. And she just said, yes, it's true. And we aren't, you know, we don't know who it is. It was anonymous. And we don't plan on telling your brother. And your dad wasn't supposed to tell you. So I'm mad at him. And then basically just closed the door. Like, that was it. We're not talking about it anymore. And that was my very first bout with depression, actually. So for the next 3 days after that, I didn't leave my bed. I cried. I remember looking in the mirror and just wondering who I looked like. I remember just replaying all these stories in my head of my dad saying, like, you have the Levitt thighs and you look like your cousin. And I was going, well, I don't have the Levitt thighs. I don't have any, I can't look like my cousin because he's not biologically my cousin. And so it was also this betrayal of my parents have been telling me a lie my whole life and I don't know who I am and I had no identity. So I created this story that, well, who's donating sperm? Somebody who needs money. Who needs money? Obviously a drug addict who can't afford drugs. And so I had this idea that my donor, my biological father, was a junkie and that I didn't deserve to be alive and that my parents were really religious and I felt that if God didn't want them to have kids, then they went like behind his back and took it into their own hands and I shouldn't be here. So that led into this, I mean, you can just obviously where that's going, like I had low self-esteem. I didn't feel like I deserved to be here. So I started cutting. Around that same time, I'm a teenager, I'm gaining weight, and my gymnastics coaches are weighing us. So I start going down the eating disorder path. And then I had a cousin who had molested me when I was about 7 or 8 years old move into our home. And so it was just like the perfect storm of timing of everything with him moving into the home, finding out about my biology, the eating disorder. And I just came to a place where I was wanting to kill myself. And I had held, my dad had guns in the house and I held a gun to my head. And I just remember like thinking I was going to do this, just not yet. And I like wanted to practice or something. And I ended up having a boyfriend. And he saw something in me and I was really like suicidal one day and I was telling him I was going to kill myself. And he made me tell my mom, he's like, she needs to take you like to a hospital. So long story short, she took me to an inpatient like mental health facility and she didn't want to. I screamed and said I needed to. And she's like, you're not crazy. You don't need to be here. I think she finally just obliged because she figured they'd turn us away. And as soon as I went to the intake, they were like, yeah, your daughter needs to be like here. And they put me on the highest suicide prevention level. And I was there for almost a month. And while I was there, I found out that I was pregnant. So I was 15 years old. I was like, I'm going to have an abortion because I don't want to get fat. I'm going to kill myself anyway, so who cares? And so I planned on the abortion. I ended up getting out and had a meeting with someone for an eating disorder clinic they were going to send me off to and met with this woman who, for some reason, I felt connected to her. And she started telling me her story. And she told me she couldn't have kids anymore because of her anorexia, that it ruined her body. And I just blurted out, I want you to have my baby. And I remember thinking like, what are you talking about? Because I had planned for the abortion like the next day. And so she goes, are you serious? And I was like, yes, I want you to have my baby. And I know like in my head, I'm screaming like, what are you talking about? You're not having this baby. And I left, called my boyfriend. I said, yeah, I told this lady I want her to have our baby. And he's like, oh, okay.
Wow.
And what ended up happening was I was about 4 months pregnant. She called me bawling. She said, I can't adopt this. It will be a private adoption. It's going to cost $50,000. We don't have the money. And I was stuck there with now knowing I had a girl. I'm 20 weeks at least. And I'm going, I don't know what to do. I can't have her here because my parents and I were just fighting all the time. Nothing was going well at home. I'm in high school. I can't even drive yet. And I started looking at other options and all I knew was that I didn't want to, like back in the old day with adoption, how they would just whisk the baby away. You don't see it. You don't know where she is. And I was like, I can't do that. So I found out a little bit more and the adoption was a little different and I could choose her parents and I was able to see her and that gave me some peace. Mm-hmm. And ultimately that's what happened. And after she was born, I remember looking at her and thinking, now I can't kill myself because what if she grows up and she asks about her birth mom and finds out she committed suicide and thinks it was her fault? And so from that moment on, I didn't really have any goals of like what I want to be when I grow up or anything like that because I never thought I'd live past like 20. And so I remember just having this very vivid thought of now I just need to find something to do. And it wasn't even like to live for anything. So I just got really like hyper overachiever. So I got straight A's, went to a new school, graduated early, went to college, got a master's degree. And that just led me on this path to where I am now. But ultimately, it was out of just wanting, I just kept having this vision of her in the future and wanting her to be proud of me because I felt like I was given a second chance. Like you have to live now because you don't want her to think it's her fault. And also, you want to be somebody that she's proud of when she meets you, instead of like, why'd you give me up if you were just going to be a loser anyway, right? So yeah, so into that, you know, I've done a lot of different things in the fitness space, and we could go off there, but.
That is some major higher conscious thinking right there, because I don't know if everybody who is in that situation, 15 years old, probably 16 when you gave birth to her, right, would go, oh, now I have to live because I have this daughter and I don't want her to think that. Like, that just shows the depth of your heart and your compassion and love that you have, or like maybe you weren't able to take care of her in that moment, but you knew you wanted to take care of her in the long run by creating an example for her when it was time for her to meet you.
You know, it's interesting looking back. I always felt, you know, they say people have an old soul. And I think when I was young, I would get a lot of that. Everybody said I seemed older than my age. And I felt, but it's funny because now I hang out with younger people. So maybe I had like a 30-year-old soul and now I just say, I'm just going to say 30.
Yep.
But it's interesting because I did have a lot of, like, looking back, I was making some really big decisions that were really mature for my age. And when I look at kids that age, I can't actually even believe that I did that. But I did feel very guided in a very weird way because I was very anti-religion. I was raised in a very strict religion. So I was really struggling with spirituality and God and the idea of all of that. Yet, even blurting out of my mouth, I want you to have my baby, I didn't feel like that came from me. It came through me. And there were so many things that I felt compelled to do that I couldn't explain, but I just was following something. I was being pulled along. And where the ideas came from, I don't know. But, you know, I feel very grateful for all of it. And there was some piece of me that, I don't know, that like knew that she needed to be taken care of and I wasn't going to be able to do that. And I remember being devastated about that too. I was jealous of her parents. I felt it was unfair that they got to raise her and they got to be her parents. But I also knew that it wouldn't be fair to her to bring her into a world that she didn't ask to be brought into that was tumultuous and crazy and, yeah, it was insane. Yeah.
So, did you get to stay in touch with the parents who adopted her?
Yeah, so the way it worked was we chose them. We didn't know their last names, and we met them about a week after she was born. And the way the agency works was they would send pictures and letters to the agency, and then we could go pick them up. So they would do it once a month till she was one, and then once a year till she turned three. And after she would turn three, nothing. So I remember when she turned three and I got the last pictures and letters, I was just devastated because I'm like, I'll never see her again until she turns 18 if she wants to find us. So we basically lost all contact. However, when she was about five, the agency had switched social workers and people, and somebody called me and they go, oh, we have some mail here for you. And it was a complete accident, but somebody had a piece of paper in there that just had a word, and I knew it had to be their last name. And this was right around when the internet came around, and it was pre-Google. I remember I searched on Alta Vista, so I knew their first name. I typed in this last name, and there were like seven people in California with the same name, and I narrowed it down, and I thought that I figured out who it was. And I sat on that for about 2 years, and then I finally sent them a letter. And I just said, hey, I don't want to freak you out. I'm not trying to come back in your life, but I know where you are. And just so you know, I've moved out and here's my email. And so ultimately, they finally responded. They were like, we were a little freaked out, but it's all good. We're glad you found us. And we just kind of made an agreement that they would email me twice a year, her birthday and Christmas, and just give me updates. So I never had contact with her, but I ended up being her adoptive dad. And he would just send me some pictures through email and just give me an update, like what she wanted for Christmas and how she's doing in school. So I had just a few year gap of nothing, but then we did stay in touch.
Oh, that's so beautiful. And again, divine at work, right? Yeah. Because there are no accidents, but the fact that you were meant to, because again, she's going to need to know what an incredible mother she has. So she's going to need to be in touch with you. And were you able to communicate with her, or was it they were just sending information to you? Did she know that you were in communication with her adoptive parents?
I think she knew. I never communicated with her, one, because I didn't want to confuse her. I wanted her to know her parents were her parents. I didn't want there to be, and I also wanted to be sensitive to her mom and dad too. Like, I don't want to be like, hey, I'm the real one, you know. So she may have known. She told me later, you know, I did meet her since, and she said she would snoop. So it sounds like she knew more than she let on. I actually kept a journal when I was 16 and 15 during the pregnancy, and I wanted her parents to give it to her when she turned 16, but she told me later that she found it when she was about 10, and she would, whenever she felt sad, she sometimes would read it. I still want to see it, actually. Who knows what I wrote at that time?
That's so cool. I'm sure she has it. Yeah, and I got to meet her when you guys launched your podcast at the opening party. And
yep. Was that the when I met her?
Yeah. On LinkedIn. And I was like, what? That is so cool. And she's such a special young woman.
Yeah, she is. Yeah, she's 21 now, which trips me out. Like, I just had my birthday, and she came out and – you know, they poured wine at the table. Nobody carded her, which she looks like she's 12. So I was like, I don't know what that's about. But it's such a trip because it's come so full circle. I was in so much agony and angst and sadness and like grief. And there was a piece of me that I was never really allowed to grieve. So once she was gone, it was like my family just swept it under the rug. Like, okay, that's done now. We don't have to talk about it. And she's gone. Like, but for me, my heart was broken. It was like a loss, as if someone had died. Yeah. And so I had to like hide that grief, and I never really got to express it.
Yeah.
And to see her and to be able to talk to her, it gave so much validation to the decision I made, because there's also that piece of you wondering, did I do the right thing? What if she hated her parents growing up? What if I made the wrong decision? What if she feels abandoned and feels like I gave her away? And we've been able to talk and hearing her side of the story. And I interviewed her on the podcast too. And she's just so amazing. And she has such a mature attitude about it. And she feels like she's in the right place, like she was in the right family. And I know my mom heard that and was kind of offended, but I felt like that was good for me. I'm like, I'm glad she felt like she was in the right family.
Yeah.
Because I chose that family for her. And I wanted her to be taken care of. And she's gone through her own struggles. Her parents got divorced. And there's things I told her. I said, look, I wanted you to have a good life, not like a perfect life. Mm-hmm. I think we all need to have struggles to build character and to build resilience and all these things that, you know, we're talking about. But yeah, it's been this amazing like full circle. And I feel like all the joy that I have from her now is equal to the amount of pain then. And so it feels like at least all that pain makes sense now. And it took so long. I mean, sometimes you feel like you're struggling, you're going through this. You're like, for why? Why am I in so much pain? Why am I hurting so bad? Why does this happen to me? And here I am 20 years later. And now I'm like, it all makes sense. And it's all beautiful. And it's all perfect.
What made sense for you?
I think, you know, the irony, when I first met her, I'm going to cry. So I wanted her to be proud of me. You know, I think I did everything for so long to be like, the one day that I meet this girl, I want her to be proud of me. And I was sitting across the table from her, and she's only 18. And I looked at her, I was like, she's a kid. And I actually don't care if she's proud of me. Like, I'm fucking proud of me. And that was like the big light bulb of my life of like, I'm so proud of myself after all of that. Everything I did, I thought it was for her, and I thought it was to prove everything, and I worked my ass off. But it just came down to like, it doesn't matter what she thinks. I'm proud of me. Mm. So, yeah.
Danny, that is so beautiful. And I really feel that that is kind of the soul's journey we're all on, is to validate ourselves, to love who we are, and to do things for us, not for others. How did you move through the grief? Because I know that's something that many people can get stuck on, or people can feel very isolated in their grief.
And
no one gets it. How do I process something so painful? But how were you able to process the grief?
I think I was really, really lucky that I had an amazing social worker who I will give so much credit to my social worker for me being here today. In fact, I wanted to become a social worker after working with her. She made me read books that were challenging for a 16-year-old. She made me read Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. Ugh,
such a good book.
And it's, you know, he's in a Holocaust concentration camp and is able to see beauty in it and like realize that the soldiers and all the things that were happening, they couldn't take away his thoughts, his attitude. And That was part of it. But to be honest, there was a lot of grief I didn't process. And it was more recently, about 2.5 years ago, my ex-husband, now ex-husband, had an affair. And that was very much close to the level of pain and anguish I felt through the adoption. And I did allow myself to grieve. And that was, it was driving around town. It was crying. It was screaming. It was going to the beach every day. I moved away, came out to Venice, and I would go to the beach every day from like 2 to 4 and just stare at the water. And I'd cry a lot. And I would, you know, talk to myself, and I would just feel it. I just let myself feel it. And later on, over the last year, I've been working with different practitioners and things. And one of the things I realized was I didn't really grieve losing my daughter. And it's funny because now I've met her, so it kind of feels like I don't need to, but I still did need to. And so I actually did a session. It was kind of a Ho'oponopono type thing. It was some body work. And we actually went back just, I want to say it was a little bit of like that and self-hypnosis, but we kind of went back into my 15, 16-year-old self. And I had this conversation with myself as now and looking back, and I told myself that I was so proud of, I was like, I'm so proud of you and what you've done. And I basically held myself and let myself cry. And I think sometimes if we do have unprocessed grief, even if it's resolved, which it has resolved with meeting my daughter, I still needed to grieve that because it was something that was so traumatic for me. And I held on to for so long. And it just really looked like, I mean, honestly, it just looked like crying it out and feeling it and letting myself be angry and also be letting myself, like having compassion for myself of how I handled it. Yeah. And I handled it the best that I could. And I pushed it away and I worked really hard and I basically focused on school and focused on all the things in front of me to ignore what was going on in the background.
And eventually it comes up to get you if you don't actually process it. And I love what I hear you sharing. It's so much of that allowing, like allowing yourself to be processing what's coming up instead of stuffing it down even more because then it'll surface. I mean, that happened for me when I repressed down a lot of anger. Mm-hmm. It's like all of a sudden it came up through my skin and I was having these weird rashes. Yes. And it's like you can try to hide and avoid and push down. But eventually it's like, oh no, you need to deal with me right now.
It's so true.
And so, and it's really just giving the space for it and holding, like you said, so much compassion for yourself in the process and knowing that you did your best in that time. If you knew better, you would have done better.
Yeah.
But you didn't. And so you did what you knew best. Yeah. And I hope that some of that grieving also was supported through what finding out when your dad was like, what he told you too when you were that young girl.
There was so many things. It's so crazy how much we push things away. And honestly, I did what I had to do because I wasn't allowed to grieve. If I was seen crying, I'd be like, what's wrong? Like, it's all done now. It's like, how insensitive is that? But my parents dealt with it the way they knew how, the best that they could. And it's interesting now because last year I was 37 and that's how old my mom was when I got pregnant. So I was making my mom a grandmother at 37. And now being this age, I put myself in her shoes and it also gave me compassion towards her because I had so much anger for her of not treating me well while I was pregnant, of like being resentful. She hated me. She was embarrassed that I got pregnant at 16. So it was like a reflection of her, right? Like I'm a bad mom because I have a pregnant teenager where I'm like, I need my mom right now. I need help. But she abandoned me. And so I also have had this compassion for her going, she was just my age now. And I was like, I would have been a bitch too if I had a teenager pregnant right now.
Right?
I'm like, dang.
I'm not going to be a grandma at 37.
Right?
What?
If I got a pregnant 15-year-old, I would be like, all right, you think you're old enough to do this? All right, let's see it. Like, I probably would have been a hard ass to her too. So there's just a lot of full circle things. But I think this is also, I do workshops and I talk about rewriting your story. And this is one of the things is like putting yourself in the other person's shoes and living it through what their scenario is. And it can really change. Even if you don't have forgiveness, you can maybe now see why they reacted the way they did or how they behaved the way they did. And now I'm going, okay, I get it. And I have more compassion towards my mom and less resentment towards my mom. And it doesn't make what she did okay. She did a lot of shitty things. And she was, you know, we talk about this sometimes. She's like, I wasn't a bad mom. I'm like, you were a bad mom. But it's okay. Like, it's okay now. I'm not holding it against you. You did shitty things. I did shitty things. I said really nasty things to you. You said nasty things to me. We just pushed each other's buttons for years. But now I can have compassion because I can step into her shoes and see from her perspective what it looked like.
Yeah, that's so huge. I mean, you said this at the start, is it's our stories and our perceptions that either empower you or they totally disempower you. And it's your choice on how you want to see it. Same thing with the book you brought up, Man's Search for Meaning, Viktor Frankl, which I love. Like, how could you, he could be in a concentration camp and find beauty in that. Yeah. Holy crap. But it just goes to show the power of the mind and what is possible when you're willing to look at things from a different angle and find the compassion. Yeah. Like, it, same thing. Like, my parents, I just had a big breakthrough with my coach where he's like, tell me about your parents' upbringing. And my mom was abandoned in China when she was 5. And my dad was sent to the United States at 17 with barely any money, didn't speak the language, and had to figure life out and sponsor the whole family over from China. And he was like, do you see that there was abandonment and lack of support when they were younger? So, of course, that's what you got.
Yeah.
And I was like, what? Like, it blew my mind. So, again, they gave you.
And they probably thought they gave you so much, like, you had more than we had.
Yes, of course.
Yeah. We gave you so much more than we had. Why are you being upset?
Yeah. And so it's the same thing with your mom, right? Like, who knows what her past was that then she brought that to parenting. And, and I just know that the more we hold on to the resentment or wishing it things were different than they were, is when we continue to create misery for ourselves. So forgiveness is so true. So key.
Forgiveness was huge. And it's so interesting because I worked on, you know, I had a lot of issues that I really attributed to the sexual abuse, and I worked through that. And that was like the big focus of a lot of therapy, but I still had all these underlying things. I was still struggling with the eating disorder. I was still struggling with anxiety and depression. And I remember going to this workshop and we were talking about forgiveness, and they're like, write one person down you need to forgive. And I wrote my mom, and I was like, I can't. And I hung on to things with my mom so much longer than anyone else. And I think a lot of us tend to do this with our parents or someone close because, like, she should have known, she should have stopped it, she should have been this way. And so it took a long, long time. And it's, I have this mentor, Danny Johnson, not me. But I found her because I was Googling it myself, but she's a really amazing author and speaker. And she says forgiveness is a habit, and you have to forgive over and over. So sometimes I think we go, well, I forgive you and I'm done. And then, like, stuff comes up and you get angry again. And then sometimes you beat yourself up for being angry. But forgiveness is a practice. Mm-hmm. You have to forgive one time, sometimes 100 times, sometimes 1,000 times, sometimes it's freaking daily. And the biggest person, the hardest person to forgive, and the one we need to forgive the most is ourselves. And that has been obviously one of my biggest struggles, but it's also been the biggest breakthroughs of when I've been able to just look at myself with compassion and go, wow, you know what? You actually did a really good job when you were 16 handling what you had dealt, you know, what was going on, the way your parents were treating you. Of course you behaved this way. Like, give yourself a break. So,
I love that so much. Forgiveness is an active practice. It's not a one-time thing. And I remember being at some talk and someone had asked the question, like, how do you know when you've fully forgiven someone or something? And the answer from the teacher was like, when you have no emotional charge towards it, or you can also wish that person well.
Yeah.
Right. So that's when you know, because sometimes we're like, oh, I forgave you.
Right.
Like, whoa, whoa, no, you didn't. Yeah. But when you can actually wish someone well, or at least, like you said again in the beginning, when you talked about it, you're like, it's so crazy. I can talk about this stuff. I can even send funny memes about people cheating.
Right.
You know, you've forgiven that and you've healed that part.
Yeah.
So, so good. You have been through so many other things. I'm just going to throw it out there and see where we go. But you also overcame paralysis. You overcame bankruptcy.
Yep.
You also overcame, like, body image stuff even later on when you were a fitness model.
Yep.
Let's try to hit all these because I think they're important.
Actually, one kind of leads into the other. So,
okay, good.
Basically, after I graduated college and I mean, I was just like I said, hyper overachiever, just straight A's, getting through school quick. I wanted to graduate. I graduated just before I turned 21, college. And ironically, my first job was as an acrobat at SeaWorld. So I'm like, yay, I have a degree and I'm going to run off and join the circus.
So
So I got this acrobatic job because I had been coaching gymnastics, and one of my students, her mom worked for Cirque du Soleil, and she introduced me to this world of performers and like Vegas style acrobatics and an aerialist. So I was an aerialist. I got a job at SeaWorld as an acrobat. And I was there for a little over a month, and literally I woke up one morning and I just fell out of bed. And my legs, it kind of felt like, you know, when your foot's asleep and it just kind of tingles. And I was like, wow, that's weird. Maybe my legs are asleep. So I went back to sleep, tried to get out of bed again. I was in excruciating pain, like tingles, pins and needles in my legs. And I ended up meeting with the physical therapist, and she goes, oh, you have sciatica. So I'm like, oh, I must have pulled something while I was performing. Well, long story short, went to the hospital. They sent me home with pain pills. Didn't do anything. 2 days later, I couldn't walk at all. I couldn't even move my legs. And so I was with a boyfriend at the time, and he's like, I don't know what to do with you. We already went to the hospital. I'm sending you home to your mom. Now, mind you, I moved out at 18, and my mom and I hadn't talked for the last couple of years.
Whoa.
So I was like, okay, yeah, what is she going to freaking do? So he calls my mom. He's like, you need to get your daughter from the airport. I don't know what to do with her. She can't walk. So my mom picks me up at the airport in a wheelchair. We like got a wheelchair. Somehow we got one. She was allowed to get access to go to the gate because this is after 9/11. She took me from the wheelchair right to the car, drove me straight to the hospital, and I ended up staying there for a month. And we found – so immediately what happened when we went to the hospital that time was they took my temperature. I had a temperature of 104.6.
Whoa.
And they were like, this isn't sciatica. Something else is happening. Like, why are you burning up? So they put me on – they just start pumping me with fluids. I don't know what's happening. After 2 days, I didn't really know what was going on then. And long story short, I found out I got a bacterial infection, a blood bacteremia, bacterial infection that lodged in my sacroiliac joint and cut off all the motor nerves to my legs. And so
– oh, my God.
I went from being a full-on acrobat, running like 3 miles a day, like fully just physically active to now I'm totally paralyzed. And – it was funny. I remember the doctor came in. It was the third day because she finally got the labs back. She goes, you have E. coli, Klebsiella, Enterobacter. Like these are 3 gram-negative bacteria. She goes, you're not going to be able to perform again. And we're not sure you're even going to be able to walk again. And I'm like, no, I need to call my boss. I need to be back by Saturday. She's like, no, honey, like you're lucky to be alive.
Wow.
And it did not even occur to me that I could have been dead. It just was, it happened so quickly. And then it was a matter of like, well, how did this happen? And ultimately, we discovered that my show was in Mission Bay, and it's very polluted, and there's a lot of sewage from Tijuana. We were not like in a tank in SeaWorld. It was in the bay. And the water is really contaminated with that kind of bacteria. And somehow, it got into my bloodstream. And I was actually lucky that it paralyzed me because I wasn't having any other symptoms, and I could have died had I not had that happen. So ultimately, it was the paralysis that got me to the hospital to even be checked out.
Wow.
So I ended up being there for about a month, and they released me with IV antibiotics. And it was really scary because it got to where they were worried about the getting antibiotic resistance, and then it could come back and then kill me still. So they wanted to get me out of the hospital to get rid of risk of infection. But I had to go back to live with my parents because I had nowhere to go. And this was an interesting thing that I think things happen for a reason, because my mom and I had a lot of unfinished business. There was a lot of resentment. So now she's bitter that I have to be taken care of. And I'm bitter because I'm so independent and I don't want to be taken care of. So we had a lot of fights at that point, but I needed her help to get dressed, to shower, to put my socks on. I needed her help to drive me to the doctor's appointments because I couldn't walk. And it was just this, I became again suicidal. And it was because I'm like, this is what I do. Like my degree was in physical education. I'm an acrobat. I can't walk. What's the point of me even living? And so I went back into that 15-year-old like suicidal place. And I had a girlfriend at the time who just got diagnosed with cancer. Her name is Kelly. And she had come to see me perform at SeaWorld, and she had just lost her hair. And I had like cut all my hair off to like support her. Mm-hmm. And she came to visit me in my mom's house after I was released from the hospital. So by this time I could use a walker. And so I could move my right leg just a little bit, my left leg, not at all. So I could lean on the walker, move my right leg, and then just drag the other side. And so I opened the door and she saw me and she was like, oh my God, Dani, I'm so sorry this happened to you. And I remember just going, and she said, it's not fair. And I was like, she has cancer and she's feeling sorry for me saying it's not fair. And everybody around her knew that she wasn't going to make it. She had colon cancer, and then it went to her ovaries and her liver. It was just all over. And when she left, I was like, I am such an asshole. Like, I have been feeling sorry for myself because I can't walk, because I'm an acrobat. And yet I still am here and I don't have a death sentence like she does. Mm. So it was just another wake up call for me, just like my daughter, of like, you're getting a second chance and figure this shit out. And so I started just doing these affirmations, and I started asking my mom to take me to the gym. I'd take my walker, sit on a recumbent bike, and just push my legs around with my hands. And I would just say affirmations like, you're getting healthier and healthier every day. You can walk easily and effortlessly, and just kind of things like that, just to get my mind right. And ultimately, when you're paralyzed, I think the only thing you want to do is walk. Mm-hmm. And once I was able to start walking again, I was like, I will never take this for granted. So I went crazy hardcore into fitness, and I started doing fitness competitions. I ran a marathon, and the fitness competition world, it just started on this body image stuff, and it brought back the old gymnastics stuff and the old eating disorder stuff. And I turned, you know, I was really obsessed, and like, I felt like it was a good thing at the beginning. I felt like more disciplined than people, and I felt that I could really handle it. But ultimately, I think when you're living on programs like that for so long, it becomes an obsession. Mm-hmm. And I started thinking like, if 1 hour cardio is good, then 2 hours is better, right? And then if eating 1,200 calories a day is good, then eating 1,000 is better, or eating 900. So pretty soon I'm doing excessive exercise, hardly eating. And I just messed up my metabolism so bad that after one of my last competitions, I gained about 30 pounds within like 6 weeks. And I did not know what was going on. I was like, I'm eating hardly anything. I'm working out a million hours a day.
Yeah, why am I getting weight coming on? Yep.
Yep. And so this just put me into this spiral of like my eating disorder started coming back. I was dealing with a business partner. I had a brand called the Sweaty Bettys. It was so into fitness. And again, now suddenly my brand is about fitness, and I'm front facing and gaining weight in front of these people. So I'm like, oh my God, I can't have this happen. And it led me down this path of like about 2 years of just fighting it. I kept trying to lose the weight, kept trying to keep doing the same things over and over, getting the same result, but you know, not realizing that was insanity. And ultimately I just decided to give up. I was like, you know what? If I'm going to get fat anyway, I might as well eat what I want and stop working out. And the irony was that when I finally surrendered, that was when everything stopped. The weight gain stopped.
Yep.
Things started to balance themselves out. I mean, it didn't happen overnight, but it was like, oh, I'm trying to control everything and it's not going the way I want. As soon as I just let it go, I was like, screw it. I'm going to let this all go. It was like, oh, look, your body does want to be just fine.
It doesn't want to be controlled anymore. Right. Thank you so much. You've done a quite fair job controlling the shit out of me. And let me show you that's not going to work.
Yes.
It's so interesting how that always leads down to the same answer. It's let go, surrender, and trust. And for us badass women who are type A, it's not, and to me, it's not really a badge of honor anymore.
No.
It used to be for me where I was like, I'm strong and I'm type A.
Yes.
And I get shit done. And now I'm like, no. It's much more easeful to be in flow and to surrender and not need a control, because I think a lot of the type A stuff is because we're so afraid of being out of control or getting hurt or our lack of trust that we feel like we need to control those things. But it's that control that causes so much damage.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And I know from another interview when I was tuning in, you mentioned that it was really hard for you because, again, your identity.
Yeah.
Was so wrapped up in all that. And that took you down another dark place. But what did you do to shift out of that?
You know, that was one of the hardest things, because my identity was wrapped up in it. And it's funny, it's like we have these repeated lessons in our lives, right? Like I identified as like being an acrobat and being fit. And then suddenly I couldn't walk. And so I was like, okay, I need to find something new. But then suddenly I'm back with the body stuff. And I identified as like, people only know me or they like me because of my body. And it turned into, this is where really a lot of the personal development stuff came back. I started to think about my best friend at the time. And I was like, if she gained 30 pounds, would I not like her anymore? I was like, no, that's ridiculous. Like, I would still love her. And so I had to turn that around and go, okay, if I look the way I do, are people not going to like me? And maybe some of them wouldn't, but the people closest to me aren't going to stop, you know, aren't going to stop liking me. And I started to go, like, what is it about me that is, like, what makes me me? If people don't like me just for my body, there has to be something else. Mm-hmm. And so it really led into this internal work of just, like, getting to know who I was. And I actually didn't know who I was. I was trying to not only control my own body, but control how people perceived me. Mm-hmm. And I think that also came from, I didn't want people to see me as the 16-year-old pregnant girl anymore. I didn't want to be, because there was so much stigma with that, right? People expected you're pregnant in high school, you're going to drop out of high school, you're going to go on welfare, and you're going to be like a piece of garbage the rest of your life. So I wanted to control everyone's perception of me. So by looking the fittest, then maybe people think I have my shit together. Looking the prettiest or whatever it is. Like we're not only controlling ourselves, we're trying to control people's perception of us.
Oh, totally. Yeah. When I did Vipassana, the teacher said, he's like, yeah. Do you know how much time and energy we spend carving an image of ourselves in the minds of others?
Yes.
We spend so much time doing that. We don't even carve our own image of who we are for ourselves.
No. Yeah.
Or uncover that. Yeah. It's insane. And then when we can't control this image anymore in their minds, it becomes devastating for us. Yeah. But really, I love what you said is it doesn't, you know, would someone still love me if I had weight on me? And it's crazy if you really think about it, how many conditions we put on ourselves that equal we are lovable.
Yeah.
Like, I have to look this way, or I have to make this much money, or I have to have these types of friends, or fill in the blank in order to be loved versus no, I'm lovable because I'm lovable.
Yeah, yeah. And the irony too is, like, at the time I also attracted a relationship that was like that. I had this boyfriend.
Of course.
Who was like, he basically was always talking about me as an acrobat. And after I was paralyzed, I'm like, that's not me anymore. But he liked the idea of me being a performer. And he also was telling me, well, I want to marry somebody who doesn't have a kid already and you do. And so it was like, I felt like damaged goods and I had to try to prove to him. And it's so interesting how we tend to attract those people because that's the ideas that we have. Instead of now today, it's like, if you don't like it, then like, bye. Yeah. Like, peace out. You don't have to like it. It's not to make you happy with me.
Yeah. But we attract what we believe.
Yeah.
And what we attract is like just reflecting back.
It's totally.
Like, hey girl, you want to know what you believe about yourself or what's possible? Look at what keeps coming into your life.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. And which is also why the same patterns keep coming up until you learn the freaking lesson to change that belief. And you're like, oh, new stuff showing up now.
Yeah. It's constant lessons. And the other part I wanted to say is about trust. It's, trust is a lesson that has kept repeating for me. Mm. It's trusting yourself, trusting that you can handle what gets thrown at you, and then like trusting your body. Like that was another big piece for me was going, I started to think back, when do I remember not thinking about food, not dieting? And it was before I was 8 years old because my mom and my grandmother had gastric bypass. My mom and grandmother were always dieting. And so I can remember from being a very little girl about dieting. So I had to go back to like when I was about 5. And I was thinking about 5-year-olds and I'm like, they don't think about food and their bodies are just, they're not fat. They're just fine. Like they move. And so I was going, my body must inherently know how to take care of itself because I wasn't counting calories when I was 5 and I was fine. So I started to just go, okay, I'm going to trust that my body actually wants to be at a certain place, that it knows what to do, that it knows how to manage itself. And that was not an easy process. And it took me, you know, I had to go through a lot of like practice of tapping and anxiety management, but ultimately it's freedom. When you finally get through it, I do not stress about everything that goes in my mouth. I'm not counting calories. I'm not worried about that. I'm also not worried that if I gain a few pounds that somebody's not going to like me or they're not going to talk to me or they're not going to think I'm attractive.
Yep. And ultimately, I think it comes back to what you said before is it doesn't really matter what they think.
No.
It's what you think. Like when you sat in front of your daughter, you know, of course, it would be amazing if she was proud of you, but that's not contingent on how you feel about yourself.
Yeah.
And so often I think we put so much of our value, but what will they think? And which is why we're spending so much energy carving an image of ourselves in their minds, control, 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 control. And that's where we're wasting our energy instead of just like shining our light of who we are.
Yeah. And it's, so often we're doing it for people who aren't even paying attention.
Right?
Right?
They don't even care. They're too busy thinking of their own shit, trying to control other people's, it could be, their image in other people's minds.
It could
literally
be like a high school boyfriend that you broke up and you're just like, you're still somehow doing it for them for something they said. And they're like, oh, I don't even remember you or saying that. And you're like, oh my gosh, what have I been doing this for?
What were some of the, because I really want to deep dive into the processes and the practices, because there's so much that you had to unpack and so much rewriting of your stories that you had to do over all these things that have stacked up over your lifetime that have led you to where you are now. What were some of the key things that you did to heal?
So first was counseling. You know, I had such an amazing, my social worker was a counselor. And so luckily after I had my daughter, part of the adoption was that they would do 1 year of counseling after. So I went to her, I want to say at least once a week for a year, maybe more. Her office was right near my school. I went to a new high school and she did a lot of different things. I'd say we did like CBT kind of therapy, just a lot of talk therapy. She made me read a lot of books. Affirmations were really big. She talked about a lot about rewiring my brain. Mm-hmm. And when I also was paralyzed, somebody gave me the book Heal Your Body, Heal Your Life by Louise Hay. And so I went through that book and I highlighted all the physical maladies I had. And then I made these affirmation cards of all of the things that I had, like, and it wasn't just, I was paralyzed, but I also had skin issues. I also had, I just had a lot of stuff. Was getting yeast infections. I was having acne. I was having thyroid problems. So I went through the list of everything and I made these cards. And when I went to sit on the bike while I was paralyzed, I also read those affirmations from the Heal Your Body, Heal Your Life. So those were things that I did, because it's interesting with affirmations where sometimes you say the thing and you feel like you're just lying. You're like, this is bullshit. Mm-hmm. But after a while, it becomes like almost your automatic thought. So that's when I noticed it really sank in. So I took French for 7 years. And when you first learn a language, you're like listening and you're translating and then you're trying to translate back. And it's like a really slow process. You're like, okay, she said this. This is what she means. Now let me translate it. Well, I went to France and after about 4 days, I started to actually think, like somebody would ask me a question in French and I could respond right away without doing this whole translation in my head. And it was like I actually thought in the language. And that was what the affirmations kind of did to me, where at first it's like, no, this is, I'm lying to myself. I'm not feeling happy. I'm not beautiful. Like all the things you just like, this is a lie. But after a while, maybe something pops up and instead of your old negative thought, the affirmation thought comes in and you're like, oh, I'm thinking different. So I really believe in affirmations. I know that not everybody is into them and I don't think it's a fix for everything, but I think that's huge.
I think that's actually really key. I want to highlight that right now because I know people are like, affirmations don't work. You know what they actually really do if you work them in the right way? Mm-hmm.
I would say that too. I was repeating them over and over and over and over and over.
Girl, eventually it's like that's how beliefs are created. Yeah. It's a thought that you keep repeating in your mind. So if you do keep repeating them, it's going to sink in. And especially there are key times when you actually go into natural states of hypnosis. Yep. Where if you say them then, the suggestions drop in faster than when you're trying to do them when you're conscious.
Yep.
Because when you're conscious, of course, that's when the judger goes, nope, that's not true. Yep. And it's harder. But if you keep challenging that part of your mind and you don't quit and you don't listen to the, this is bullshit.
Yep.
I don't believe this. And you just keep going anyway. Eventually it's like, all right, looks like she's in charge.
Yep.
And this is what she wants to put in her mind. And let's rewire this sucker now.
Yeah.
So affirmations do absolutely work, but you gotta stick with them.
Yeah.
How did you write yours?
So some of them I found online. I would write them, like a lot of them would be, I am, you know, whatever. Gosh, I wish I brought with me. I just found one of my old books. And there was this eating disorder website that had a list of like 1,200 also. So some of them I found on there. They were things like, I will not anticipate my pain until it is present. Like things like that were kind of just rewiring how I thought, because sometimes we get so anxious about what's going to happen and we're not even present in the moment. We're already worried about the future. Mm-hmm. So things like that, I will not anticipate my pain until it's present. Then of course the affirmations from Louise Hayes, that some of them, a lot of them had to do with, I trust the process of life. Some of them were just
relating to me just physically. Like I am walking easily and effortlessly because I wanted to be walking again, or I am healthy and beautiful, things that I didn't believe, but I wanted to believe. So they were all a little different, but I put them on cards. And actually what I did was I'd do them during cardio a lot. And I would make myself, one of the reasons is just to pass the time because cardio is boring as hell.
You are such a multitasker. I know.
So I would read each one 10 times. And I'd go through it and I'd just go 10 times, 10 times, 10 times. And if I got through it and I still had, you know, 10 minutes left, I'd just start over. So I was doing them like high repetitions every single day.
And getting it in your body because you're moving.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's something that I didn't realize that was so powerful, but I was like, this is why I think it really worked.
Yep.
So affirmations, huge. And I have a list. I mean, if anybody wants them, they could always DM me. I have that original eating disorder one, which I went through and just picked the ones that felt like they resonated to me. Some of them didn't, some of them did, but not all of them had to do with eating disorders. Mm-hmm. And even the pain one, ironically, I found it recently and I've been having some neck pain and I'm like, this actually is valid for me today. Like I was getting scared of moving because my neck might hurt. And then I was like keeping myself from doing things that I could do instead of just seeing what happens and trusting that if I get in pain, then I can figure it out. Then I also did hypnosis. Couple years later, I want to say this was after my paralysis. I was going through business partner breakup, going through the food stuff, like my body image and my gaining the weight. Super anxious. I saw a Groupon for hypnotherapy. And I was kind of like, this is BS. It's bull, you know, it sounds hokey, but I was so desperate because I was in so much constant anxiety and I was just unable to manage. I was like, I'll give it a shot. And after my first session, I immediately found the source of my anxiety, went back to that conversation with my dad in the car, telling me that I wasn't his daughter or that he wasn't my dad. And it shifted all my anxiety going forward. And I took 3 sessions with that hypnotherapist. I ended up buying a few more. And that was another piece. So I think there's not just one tool. I think sometimes we have to try a lot of different angles. EMDR has worked for a lot of people. I haven't done it. I keep wanting to, but I haven't. But therapy and even medication. I've been on meds off and on, and it's been a tool that I've needed to help me sometimes get through moments that I've dug myself into such a spiral of thoughts that I couldn't feel that I could get out quickly before I did something stupid. But I think there's so many things, and it's necessary to talk about that, to know that a lot of this isn't also going to happen overnight. Healing, it's like healing a bone. You can't expect a bone to just fix itself overnight. You have a cast for 6 weeks. Certain things take a longer time. Like your heart may take a longer time to heal. A lot of things are going to take a long time to heal, but they don't have to take so long if you can, you know, if you put a splint on, like your arm is going to stay broken if you keep using it and you're not putting it in the cast. So you need to find those things so you can get through it faster.
Yeah. And I love what I know one of your messages is there is no one right way.
Yeah.
But what you did where you're like, I will try anything, right? And so it's your willingness to be open to trying different things to find what works for you.
Yeah.
Because it's going to be different for everybody. Yep. And here's also the big key that I always say to people. It's like, it's also your level of belief in that thing.
Yes.
That it's going to work,
yeah.
That is going to have it work. Because if you have a paradigm that nothing is ever going to work, no matter what I do, nothing changes. Or when I hear people say, I've tried everything. I'm like, really everything?
Yeah.
You tell me what everything is and we'll see if that's really accurate. But no, it's just their like fear to change.
Yeah.
But if you're willing and you put some belief in a modality, a tool or a practice, it's going to have a much higher chance of actually working for
100%.
You. Because you're aligning your mind and your belief with the thing to work.
Yeah.
And you know that it's possible for you to get through it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think too, even belief in someone else's story, if they've done it, then I can. And that actually was a big piece that has pulled me through so many times. And I think that's why I share my story too, because there are people like the woman who said she couldn't have a baby, and the one I wanted to give my daughter to initially, she was sharing with me her struggles through her eating disorder, and she was healed and she was happy. And she was sad because she ruined her body, but she had gotten through it. And her story that she could get through the eating disorder gave me faith that it's possible, because sometimes we are like, if we think I tried everything, nothing will work for me, then we're kind of stuck. Mm-hmm. So I try to find that person like, well, she had the same or similar scenario as me and she got through it. And when I found out my husband was having an affair, my friend Jill, who's my podcast partner, she had just gone through the same thing about a year before me. And if I had not known her, I don't know how I would have gotten through it, but I saw that she had a year ahead of me. So she had worked through so much. And I'm like, how are you doing this? Like, and she was able to kind of go, look, you're going to feel like this for a while and that's okay. And you're going to be angry and that's okay. And it's going to feel like the twilight zone. And everything she said, I was like, oh my God, yes, that is how it feels. That is how I feel. And I think if you can find someone who's maybe a few steps ahead of you, who's already gone through it, that can give you just enough faith to just keep moving. Because sometimes it really is just that, like knowing if somebody else has gone there, then you're like, you can do it. If they can, then I can. Because it's such a struggle. You feel so alone.
Yeah. Which, by the way, Jill is episode number 47.
Nice.
And she talks all about her healing. And Jade was actually episode 37. Oh my God, it was cool to hear both sides of the story, his side and her side. I want to touch on this before we close this out, because I think this is really key and I want to know what your steps were, but you also overcame bankruptcy and now you support people in helping them become debt free.
Yeah.
Cliff notes. Yeah. I know this is such a big topic, but I just want to give this gift to the people listening in case this is something they're struggling with.
Totally. So it's so interesting. Just like we said earlier, the food is not about the food. The money's not about the money.
Yep.
And I found, so I was doing the Sweaty Bettys and I started to have a lot of binge eating people that were coming to me. They were like, just tell me what to do and I'll do it. I just need to lose 30 pounds. And they were so just like, I need to lose the weight. And I would talk to them more and get into some deeper issues. And it seemed like a lot of them had debt and money and financial issues as well, and maybe relationship stuff or unresolved trauma. And so I found this interesting correlation, and I've been working on this book. I should have put it out a couple years ago, but I didn't. It's called Lose the Clutter, Lose the Pounds, Find the Money. And I find that the mindset, the lack mindset that comes around binge eating, it's like there's not enough food, like I eat it all, or it's like I'm like starting the diet on Monday, so I'm going to eat everything on Sunday. Well, we do the same thing with money. It's like you get your paycheck and you spend it all at once because you don't know when the money is coming. And so there's this mentality of there's not enough, so I got to use it all now, or I got to pay everything now or hoard money. And so my ex-husband and I, we were in Las Vegas. The economy crashed. We basically lost everything. We had to move to another state, start over. And this was at the same time my business was falling apart with my business partner. And I was just devastated. I'm like, I have $30,000 in student loans for my master's degree. My husband's got a $30,000 a year job. I just moved to another state, so I have no clients. And I'm just turning 30, and I'm like, I thought I would be in a better place by now. I should be in a bigger house with a nicer car, and now I'm in an apartment with no car, and we're not making any money. And I was just like, I can't handle this. I can't be in this space of not having enough. And I kept thinking money was going to fix the problems. If we just like won the lottery, then we'd be fine. And I was Googling, literally, I was looking for contests to win because I didn't know how else to bring in income. And I came across this woman, Dani Johnson, and she has a book called First Steps to Wealth. And I read that book and it changed my life. And ultimately, I went to a seminar called First Steps to Success that really changed my life. But what she really preaches, and one thing that I became my mantra, was to be faithful with the little things. So, and she got this from the Bible, and I'm not a Bible person, so I'll just tell you what I heard from her, is there's a passage in the Bible that says, when you're faithful with the little things, you'll be made ruler over much. So if you're given—
Say that again.
If you're faithful with the little things, you will be made ruler over much. Okay. And one of those— so for example, if you have a salary of $2,000 a month, and you're spending that on ridiculous things and wasting it, or you're just pissed like, I should be making more— why would the universe bless you with more if you're not being faithful with that 2000, right? It's just like, I think about this. If you give a fifth grader an iPad and they take it and go smash it against the wall and they're like, I want a new iPad. Are you going to give it to them? Like, no, you didn't take care of what I gave you. So faithful with the little things, I was like, I was complaining. I'm like, we're in an apartment. We only make $35,000 a year. I'm just bitching about everything. And I'm not looking at what I actually have and going, I have an apartment. we have a salary. We can do something with this instead of going out to dinner or like being frivolous with our money. So we started to be faithful about all our purchases. We started to be more faithful about how we just received money. I'm grateful. And gratitude is a huge practice that I didn't mention earlier, but that's massive. And the craziest thing happened. Within 90 days, we paid off $18,000 of debt. Obviously, my husband was only making about $2,500 a month. So I created a new business that just came out of nowhere. I had money that was sent to me, like people that owe me money that I completely forgot about from years before. Like so many miracles happened because we became intentional and we became faithful with what we had. And so Dani Johnson, while she has a great program and her money stuff really changed my life, she is a little bit more religious and didn't have things laid out in a way that I felt like everybody could really do. And people started asking, how do we do this? So I started to just break it down into like different steps. And so I created something called Find the Money Project. It's free. I do have a program that you can purchase if you want to keep going down the path of the money mindset. But in Find the Money Project, the average person, and I've had probably over 7,000 people do it, the average person finds $1,800 in 2 weeks.
Wow.
And it's incredible because most people, like myself, just feel like there's no money. I don't have it. And it's like, it's actually there in front of you,
mm-hmm.
but we are just so blind to it because we keep thinking, well, if just more comes, everything will be fine. But you're not going to get more until you are faithful with what you have.
Totally. And shifting where you're looking. If you're staring at not enough, scarcity, yeah. I'm always going to run out of it, it's going to perpetuate that. And again, remember, your reality is a reflection of your inner world. Yeah. So you'll keep getting more of that. But when you start being faithful to the things, having gratitude, seeing abundance everywhere, all of a sudden you'll be right because here comes all the abundance again.
And so true.
It's again, just like forgiveness, it's a practice and it's a willingness to change and rewire your mind to see things differently.
Yeah. It's so cool. Like, it's one of my favorite things that I do because it's amazing what $500 a month for somebody can shift everything for you. Yeah. I mean, that's like, okay, cool. That's some breathing room. That's paying your car payment and not stressing. There's so many things that people just, it's like they suddenly, it's almost as if it's like when you have your sunglasses on your head and you're like looking around the room, like, where are my sunglasses? And somebody points it out. It's like, it's something that's there all along and you just finally open your eyes to it. And people are just shocked. And it shocks me, the stories that I hear and what happens as you become intentional about it 60 days, 90 days later, like you can have a completely brand new financial life. And it also lends into your food and your relationships. It's interesting how many people have shifted their marriages after going through it and shifted their eating and going through it. So many of these are tied together. The ideas of faithful with the little things tie into every little piece and aspect of your life. So it's not about the money, but we use the money as a tool to like highlight how you're doing things with the rest of your life.
Mm. Dani, how is it an hour already? We can sit here all day, please.
Yes.
Thank you for that.
Yes.
And this is just what's coming up for me to say. It's like, can you imagine also if you're being faithful with yourself?
Yeah.
Like self-honoring. And I'm guessing that's really where you came to when you're sitting in front of your daughter and you were at the place of like, I'm actually proud of me.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a victory right there. All right, a few more things, a few more questions just to close this out.
Yeah.
What is something unique about you that most people don't know?
Oh my gosh. Well, it's not totally unique to me now, but I do have a sperm tattoo on my foot.
I need to see this. Show me.
Oh my gosh. I got it last year.
Should we put this in the show notes?
Yes.
Here's Dani's sperm tattoo. Nice. Oh my gosh, I love that so much.
When I found out about my sperm donor, I ended up meeting multiple siblings and now I have 20 half siblings and we
what? Yeah.
So we got matching sperm tattoos last St. Patrick's Day.
Oh my god. Are you literally dropping that at the end? What is happening?
I know, love to have round two on that. That's a whole other story of identity.
Round two coming up. What the girl? Okay.
Hey, you asked.
I know. It's so good. When you're in a dark place, what's your go-to to get out?
I'd say when I'm in a dark place, my go-to to get out is, for the most part, gratitude. Usually my dark place is when I'm feeling sorry for myself or I'm comparing. And when I start to turn it around, whatever it is like when I'm grateful for where I am or what's around me. If I'm, you know, when I'm in a dark place, it's kind of like I'm comparing myself to someone. Oh, look, they have more money and they're hustling and they're freaking rocking it. And I'm like, look at me. I don't have that car and I don't have this. And then I'm like, well, what do I do? You know, I have my health and I have amazing friends and I go into gratitude. I just start listing things that are like I do have because then I start feeling really, really blessed.
Yeah. What you appreciate appreciates, right? And so even when you can be happy for them for having it, it's basically saying, oh, and I can welcome that into my life too.
Yeah.
So good. So good. And knowing what you know now, I'm going to switch this up for you. Because usually the question is, knowing what you know now, what advice would you give your 10-year-old self? Mm-hmm. I'm going to say, knowing what you know now, what advice would you give your 15-year-old self?
You know what's so crazy is I just went to Rhythmia and did this ayahuasca ceremony. And I actually got to be in that place. And I sat with my 16-year-old self in the hospital. And it wasn't really advice, but I wanted to tell myself that I was so proud of what I did. And I wanted to tell myself that everything was going to be okay. And I was like, it's going to be amazing. Everything is going to work out. And as I was telling my younger self that, I realized I needed to hear it today. Like, whatever I'm going through today, everything is going to work out. I know it will. It always has. So my advice would just be like, it's going to be okay. I don't even know if that's advice, but just trust it. Like, it's going to be okay. Don't overthink it.
I love that. And I actually say that to myself at times when I can spiral. And just those words alone can be so calming. Like, it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
Okay. It's going to be okay.
Don't know how, but it will be.
But it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
Dani, where can people connect with you?
You know what? Instagram is a really good spot. I'm at dannyj.com, D-A-N-N-Y, like a boy, and then spellout.com, D-O-T-C-O-M. That's probably the best way. I'm on like Facebook, same place, LinkedIn, same place. You can email me. I'm at dannyj.com on my website, but Instagram's a great place. And then you could find me on the Best Life podcast.
Yeah.
Tell lots of fun stories on the podcast. So we also have an Instagram, the Best Life podcast.
Awesome. And I will link all of that up in the show notes so y'all can go head over there and find Dani J.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. You are freaking awesome. And we might need to bring you on for part two. Talk about that sperm tattoo. Like, I can't believe he's got 20 other kids out there. Or 19 and a half, you
there's
said?
There's potentially over 100.
Well, he got paid.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Dani, thank you. I love you. You're amazing.
Thank you.
How incredible is Dani J? I just love her energy and her raw honesty. And that beautiful moment that she shared when she sat in front of her daughter when they were reunited and she felt so proud of herself. You guys, that shows the power of doing the inner work. And that is self-love. You know, even when Dani was doing the hypnosis and she did the healing work to speak to her younger self, that is another act of self-love, because so much of our suffering that we experience right now and the habits and the patterns that keep running our lives that no longer serve us are all coming from a lack of self-love and from the wounding that we experienced when we were younger. So it's so important to do the deep inner work to heal the trauma and the pain so that you can be free. And if you're a regular listener, you know that I always prescribe self-love as one of the greatest salves to heal any pain or wound that we've experienced in the past or that we're currently experiencing. And I'm also deeply passionate about how powerful hypnosis is for healing traumas and empowering you through reprogramming new beliefs that align with who you want to be and what you want to achieve so that you can have and become it. You know, it's truly one of my greatest gifts working with my clients in hypnosis to support them in creating rapid change. And of course, it's also another one of my greatest gifts, teaching a pathway to deeply loving yourself, to heal the inner struggle, to release the self-doubt and the self-judgment so that you can access true happiness and inner peace and to break free of what's been holding you back, to feel fully empowered to go after what you want and to feel worthy of receiving it. So if you want some support with opening up yourself and your heart to your own love to heal and to rise up, you know I gotcha. You definitely want to go check out my 40-day self-love transformation course. It's an online course that you can access from anywhere in the world, and it shows you exact steps, processes, and daily practices to release that negative self-talk and those beliefs and to replace them with love. Now, these are all the teachings, tools, and practices that actually work because I've worked them on myself. And in all the years that I've been coaching and doing hypnosis, I've had thousands of people around the world go through this program, and they've had massive results when they've implemented what I shared with them. So things like creating healthy relationships, to pursuing lifelong dreams, to attracting the love of their life, overcoming addiction, strengthening family relationships, to achieving their personal goals, and you know what? To just straight up feeling confident and good about themselves. So if you're ready and you want a blueprint to develop profound self-love, then you definitely want to check out that course, and that's over at 40dayselflove.com. That's the number 40dayselflove.com. And I've got a gift for you. You can use the coupon code LOVE50 at checkout to save $50 off the course. All right, I hope you enjoyed this episode. And if you know someone who could benefit from it, please share it with them. Also, if you got value today and it feels aligned for you, I'd be deeply grateful if you'd just take a quick moment to leave me a 5-star review on iTunes, because those reviews are super helpful to get my rankings up so more people can find this podcast and to get all the incredible stories, wisdom, and golden nuggets of goodness from my guests to support them in rising higher and being their best selves, which of course, we all want that. Okay, to close this out, if you want to connect with Danny J and for all the resources from today's episode, all the links are in the show notes, and that's over at stephaniekwong.com/EP52. And when you go to that link, you can check out all my other podcast episodes there too. All right, you beautiful souls, until next time, I'm sending you so much love.